she made such an impact.
I'm sure you've got a lot of memories of your own interactions with her, but you were in charge of Blue Peter's 50th birthday celebration at Buckingham Palace, so you must have seen the Biddy interacting with the late Queen.
Yes, and I had the privilege of taking the Queen round and introducing her to all the former editors and presenters. And I think what's interesting is that John Noakes was there, and there was a lot of warmth, you know, towards her from the other presenters. And the Queen, we know, watched Blue Peter as a child herself. And that's why she was so warm towards it and was so keen to honour it. And, Biddy, by being in charge for 23 years, with those sort of, kind of hanging on to it, for so long, she really made it an institution.
Listen, we have to wrap up now, because otherwise the program director of Times Radio will tell me off. Thanks very much, Tim. That's it from me today on The Times at One. My producer was Lizzie Highfield, and Ryan Boyden was my technical operator. Next on Times Radio, Jane Garvey.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. It is 2 o'clock. It's Jane Garvey on Times Radio until four. And on the programme today, kicked out before they can appeal. The government says foreign criminals from a score of countries will be deported if they've committed a serious crime. An immigration lawyer will tell us just how realistic that plan is. Israel's killing of at least 5 journalists in Gaza has been condemned as an assassination. Israel says one of their number was a Hamas fighter. We'll talk to the Committee for the Protection of Journalists and get the latest on the ground from a newly returned British doctor. A ring of steel around the Cotswolds as JD Vance, US Vice President, takes a holiday there. We're asking why everyone is so obsessed with that particular part of England. And we're asking, honestly, is it that much cop? And my big interview after 3:30 is with the author Abigail Leonard on her book 4 Mothers, A Year of Motherhood Around the World. That's all coming up between now and 4. The news at 2 first from Andy Hay.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. Palestinians are mourning 5 Al Jazeera journalists killed in an Israeli strike last night. Their funeral has drawn crowds in Gaza City today. The Israeli military claims one of them, Anas al-Sharif, was working for Hamas, something the broadcaster denies. Ami Ayalon is a former head of Israel's Secret Service and Navy. He's told Times Radio the conflict in Gaza started as a defensive war and was just, but he says it's now gone too far and needs to stop. And he claims the administration is extreme.
The Israeli government is in minority. Israeli government today is led by the most extreme right wing of the concept of Judaism. They believe in racism and Jewish supremacy, and their political goal is to conquer or to annex Gaza and to annex the West Bank and to build more settlements.
Benjamin Netanyahu said yesterday that Israel is not trying to occupy Gaza, but to free it from Hamas. Volodymyr Zelensky has said that concessions do not convince a killer ahead of ceasefire talks in Alaska on Friday. Donald Trump will host Vladimir Putin, with the Russian leader reportedly demanding Ukrainian territory as part of a peace deal. White House officials say they're working to get all 3 leaders there at the same time. But Ukrainian MP Kira Rudik says there's no guarantee the Kremlin would uphold a deal.
Everybody's looking at easy questions of would they meet, of what would they discuss. But still, there is no answer to the most complicated question. How do you make sure that Russia will keep their part of the bargain? Because right now, President Trump was not even able to get them to the ceasefire.
The number of prisoners in England and Wales has hit its highest level in almost a year. More than 88,000 are now behind bars. That's up more than 1,200 in the last 2 months, despite thousands of inmates being freed early. Drivers over the age of 70 could face mandatory eye tests as part of an overhaul of road safety laws. It's described as the biggest shake-up of driving rules for almost 2 decades. The CEO of Age UK, Paul Farmer, has told Times Radio, the age of 70 seems a bit arbitrary.
Well, I don't think it's entirely dependent upon age. I think it's an interesting question about why 70 is that point. And it could potentially be older, it could potentially be younger. And I think it's just a question of ensuring that we think about a regular eye test for drivers of all ages.
In football, Crystal Palace have lost an appeal after being demoted from the coming season's Europa League. They went to the Court of Arbitration for Sport after UEFA ruled they had breached multi-club ownership rules. They'll now be in the Conference League instead. And an amber heat health alert has been issued for large parts of England. From tomorrow, temperatures could reach 35 in Celsius. That's 95 in Fahrenheit. The alert covers the East and West Midlands, East Anglia, London and the South East from 9 a.m. And for a news bulletin, when you want it, search for a Times News briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
95 Fahrenheit. You never want to hear that, do you? Welcome to the programme. It's Jane Garvey here on Times Radio. Until four, so between now and then, JD Vance is in the Cotswolds. But surely, with the greatest respect to Kingham and Chipping, you know what, there must be better options for a British holiday. Where would you suggest? 0333 003 2353. We'll also discover what everybody of my generation genuinely owes Biddy Baxter, the legendary boss of Blue Peter, who has died at the age of 92. Peter Purvis coming up on the programme before 3 o'clock. The Trump-Putin summit is in Alaska on Friday. What on earth can that hope to achieve? And is there any chance at all that President Zelensky of Ukraine will get an invitation as well? It's Literary Salon Monday, so Robbie Millen joins us between 3 and 4. Also, money matters. It matters all the time. It really matters here on a Monday. We'll talk personal finance with Adam Shaw, who this week will discuss improving your credit rating. That's around about 10 to 4 this afternoon. And after 3:30, you've got the journalist Abigail Leonard on her book, Four Mothers, A Year in Motherhood Around the World. Where do you think you'd be preferring to give birth if you were in a position to consider it? Would you choose Finland, Kenya, the USA or Japan? She follows four mothers, four very different mothers actually, through the first year of motherhood, way back in, well, not that far back, in 2022. So these were babies conceived during the COVID pandemic. How was their first 12 months? How did it pan out across those four very different parts of the world? Abigail with us after 3:30 this afternoon. Now, the most read stories on the Times website. At number three, in the town that fears homes for migrants are spoiling its streets, the Times reports on the hundreds of homes around Bolton being transformed into HMOs, or houses of multiple occupancy, as the government tries to stop keeping migrants in hotels. Now, this is about a place called Horwich, which is just outside the centre of Bolton. If you know that part of the world, you, I'm sure, will know it far better than me. You can let us know what you think about it. I'd love to hear from you this afternoon. After three, I'm going to be talking to a local councillor who is campaigning on the issue. A lot of people feel very strongly about these HMOs. The second most read story, drivers over 70 who fail eye tests face ban in road safety overhaul. This is about drivers over the age of 70 who fail compulsory eye tests. They're going to be banned from the roads under the government's new road safety strategy. And the most read piece, sleepy Cotswold hamlet on lockdown as JD Vance's holiday gets underway. US Vice President Vance's visit to the area has caused a bit of a stir for anybody passing through the hamlet of Dean. They are being greeted with US Secret Service officers at every road and footpath, checking IDs as people just mind their own business, going for walks with the dogs and just coming in and out and generally popping around and pottering. It's causing quite the commotion. You can read all of these articles on thetimes.com. You will need a digital subscription, and you can get one by going to thetimes.com/subscribe. So to the big story of the day, really, changes to the immigration system will see criminals from almost 24 countries deported before any appeal. Foreign citizens from places like India, Kenya and Uganda, convicted of crimes in the UK, will lose their right to stay in this country while they challenge the decision to remove them. Alex Davis-Jones is the Parliamentary Under-Secretary for Victims. Times Radio Breakfast Kate McCann asked whether the government can guarantee the foreign criminals will serve out their full sentences if they're deported.
That is on their country of origin who is returning them. It is up to that country to decide what happens to that individual. But what I would say is that these foreign criminals would be deported at some point anyway. And what we are saying as the government, and I think what the public are rightly saying, is why should we be paying for this? Why should we be paying the bed and board for these foreign criminals in our prisons? It costs nearly £54,000 a year to house a prisoner in England and Wales. And we feel like that taxpayers' money should not be going to that foreign criminal.
Let's have a word with Ivan Sampson, CEO and Head of Immigration at Privatus Law. It is Privatus Law, isn't it, Ivan?
It is, yes,
yeah.
Correct.
Thank you very much for your time this afternoon. Can you just take us through the basics here? Why have these countries been chosen?
Well, I think it's discriminatory. I mean, these countries, it's justice according to what passport you hold. And it's discriminatory because it discriminates against brown people. And that's one thing we all have in common. So if you are a foreigner from, say, a country which is mainly Caucasian, you won't have a problem. What concerns me is the government's blatant disregard for justice and fairness and the right to an appeal. Because everyone has a right to appeal, and what they're trying to exclude is Article 8 of the Convention. This is what this is all about. You see, many of these criminals didn't get a British passport. They may well have indefinite leave to remain, some of them. However, because they're not British, and quite often because the cost of British is so exorbitant,
right.
Many of them may have lived in the UK for decades, may have families in the UK, have children.
Yes, I mean, but I can hear people screaming at the radio saying, yes, and some of them have carried out some pretty heinous acts. They didn't need to.
Yes, I understand that. But there's a principle that your sentence ends when you complete your sentence. Punishment ends. And what this policy is doing is, once you've paid your price to society, and the price they pay for doing the wrong is they lose their liberty. And once you've lost your liberty and done your sentence, you then can't have an additional punishment that you can't challenge the decision to deport you. You see, it's not that you can't be deported. There's very strong laws in this country. For example, if you commit an offence that carries more than 12 months imprisonment, there's automatic deportation. And that's absolutely fine. Very strong laws we have to deport people. This is my problem. There's no appeal rights. So if you have been living here since childhood and you've got family and entrenched life here, and you've rehabilitated from coming out of prison, and you've served your time, then you get sent back to a country you have absolutely no connection to. That is unjust, unfair, unreasonable, and disproportionate.
So what do you
and
think?
It's a gimmick. It's a political.
Okay.
This is all political.
Yeah.
From the government.
Well, let me take you up on the idea of it being a gimmick. Do you understand why the government, in its current position, might feel the need to have a policy of this nature, which you describe as a gimmick?
Well, it's mob rule here, isn't it? I mean, you get some protests on the street. Government worry, oh my God, we've got to do something because a few thousand people are complaining and shouting and screaming. So let's have a policy. Look, the government's role in society is to make fair and just decisions, quite often, sometimes, against what the public are saying. And a society's treated, and a society is well known for how it's treated, judged, how it treats its most vulnerable, the minority. People who don't have a right of appeal.
Right.
So I'm afraid this policy it won't fly. First of all,
Well, I'm really interested in that. Why won't it work practically?
Because there'll be further challenges to it. As soon as they start putting the process in, because you're excluding the right of appeal, and they can do that through what's called certification, for example, in asylum claims. And if they're going to stop you from appealing, you need to have a challengeable way to stop that process, to stop you appealing. That will be judicial reviews. So the High Court will get involved in this, no doubt.
And
so if there's no right to appeal, these individuals will go to the High Court and judicial review that decision.
Right.
So you're going to have that go all the Supreme Court to decide this. It will take time.
Right. So effectively, this will solve nothing at all and may end up costing the taxpayer a load of money.
Well, look, imagine if I'm in, you know, I wasn't born in this country. Okay, not born here. I came into the UK when I was 4 years old. Now, imagine if I end up committing a crime, which, right, wrongly, I commit a crime. I go to prison, I come out, and they send me back to a country I have absolutely no connection with. In anyone's books, that is not fair. It's unjust, unreasonable, and disproportionate. And what you're doing is two-tier justice system, one for people who are not born here and who are not... I'm actually British, but did you know I could still be deported out of the country, even though I'm British?
But, I mean, I'm just looking at the message board I've got in front of me here. Everybody is making essentially the same point, but let me just put this to you. Here's one. It's anonymous, I'm afraid. I'd always prefer you to give your name, by the way, when you're messaging the station. But the listener says, foreign criminals have no rights to stay in our country. We don't want them here. Does this man not understand that the British have had enough? If you're convicted, you have no right to appeal. I just want them deported, deported, deported. What is your answer to that?
Well, in a society which has no justice, absolutely fine. Let's do that. So there's countries let's give you North Korea. Great. I mean, they have those sorts of policies. They just kick you out. But not in our society. We, as British people, treat everyone fairly and give everyone a right to challenge a decision. Now, how do you correct a miscarriage of justice? And those are the grey cases. So if there's been a miscarriage of justice and somebody's deported and some 10 years down the line, that person didn't actually do it. How do you resolve that?
But on the other hand, British taxpayers clearly are sick to death of having to fork out for housing and food for foreign-born criminals in our jails. Our prison system is creaking, to put it mildly, and there's quite a big proportion of foreign-born criminals in our jails.
Look, I understand the frustration, but this is a headline-grabbing gimmick, and we'll see people ripped away from their families before they've had a fair chance to challenge.
OK, look, carry on.
I was going to say, The way to deal with our prison systems is to have a better criminal justice system, to have better rehabilitation, education. And it's not by deporting foreign criminals. That is not going to solve it. Even if you deport every foreign criminal, the same problems we'll face in the system without them. So who do we then blame after that?
Thank you. Thank you very much indeed for your time and for putting your points so forcibly. And of course, you're welcome to comment as well on 0333 003 2353. That was Ivan Sampson, CEO and Head of Immigration at Privatus Law. Right. News from the Cotswolds. Local residents in the Oxfordshire hamlet of Dean, says Joshua, are so angered by the disruption caused by JD Vance's summer holiday that they're threatening to write a letter. Right, OK, so it's really kicking off in the Cotswolds. Now, let's focus on this important issue. I mean, we should be flattered in a way that the US vice president, who presumably could go anywhere, has chosen to come to England on his holes. But it has had quite the impact on the Cotswold hamlet of Dean. The holiday that the Vances are enjoying has meant that roads have been closed and US Secret Service agents have been checking cars passing through. And perhaps you, like me, have read about this in the Times today, and there's something quite irritating about some of these Secret Service agents who apparently have been impersonating what they believe to be British accents and also saying how strange it is that it's quite hot and they never thought they'd need sunblock in the UK. And that's just insulting, because we all know how hot it is in England throughout the summer months, all the time. But I just thought it might be worth asking a travel journalist whether there were other places you could visit in Britain that aren't as ubiquitous as the Cotswolds. We do seem to hear a lot about the Cotswolds. They have a sort of celebrity quota, don't they? There's usually lots of famous people who make their holiday homes there and end up living there most of the time. So let's bring in travel journalist Emma Gregg. Emma, do you get the Cotswolds? Do you think they are really lovely and worth visiting?
Oh, hello. Well, yes, of course, they are absolutely fabulous, aren't they? I mean, they're quintessentially English, which is, I think, perhaps why people from elsewhere, from the States in particular, perhaps are so attracted by the idea of visiting, staying there. You know, they're so green and pleasant, and there's lovely Georgian mansions and honey-coloured cottages with roses from the door. I mean, that is just, like, it's a dream, isn't it, to spend a little bit of time in a place like that. So yes, I do get it, and they're, you know, they're really handily located as well, particularly for somebody who's flying in, because they're not all that far from London, not far from Heathrow, not far from Oxford. Or, I mean, super handy if you're flying in by helicopter, of course. So I do get it, but no, they're by no means not the only lovely corner of our country at all. I mean, there are places which are just as lovely, and I would like to argue much more authentic feeling and much better value as well.
Okay, well, let's hear about some of the others.
Yeah, well, I mean, let's think about Wales, for example. You know, if you just travel. Keep on travelling west from the Cotswolds and hop across into Wales. You're in a different country, a different atmosphere, a very, very rich in heritage, superb landscapes, and really these days a really buzzing locally centred, local ingredients centred food scene, which is really exciting. Amazing coastline, superb water sports and other outdoor activities like hiking and sailing, and just loads and loads to do. Plus, of course, you know, really famous historic spots like those superb castles and country houses and gardens and the like. So yeah, and that it's a little bit further to travel, particularly, I say, if you're coming in from overseas, you're dropping at Heathrow, you've got to go a bit further, but so worth it, I would say.
Yeah, I hadn't really thought about it. I mean, you're right, it's the Cotswolds' proximity to London that makes them super popular with the uber rich, I guess, which, yeah. I mean, there's more to Britain than London. There always has been, there always will be. So that's Wales, which is absolutely beautiful. Where else would you point to?
You know, if you swing round the compass up to the northeast, Northumbria is also just fantastic. And if you're the kind of person, if you're a celebrity and you want to get away from it all, that's quite a good choice, I'd say, because it's a under the radar kind of region. Lots of big open spaces and, you know, beautiful coastline and great weather, because it's on the east side of the country. It doesn't get hammered by all the rain that the west side suffers from. Northumbria, it's just one of those places, I think, which really deserves more attention because it is so beautiful. And the people are just fabulous, really, really hospitable and hilarious and charming. So, yeah.
Okay, well, you've done a good job and you've pointed to some alternatives. We appreciate it. Thank you very much indeed. Was the travel writer and journalist Emma Gregg. And it's just worth saying that Fee and I were at the Fringe by the Sea Festival in North Berwick in Scotland on Friday. And that is also a truly beautiful part of the UK and so well worth a visit. It's Times Radio. And next we're going to talk about Biddy Baxter, the woman who gave us, really, Blue Peter. What a woman she was. It's 22 minutes past two.
You've worked hard to build your business, so it's important it's properly protected. At NFU Mutual, our tradesman insurance has received a 5-star rating by Defaqto for the past 10 years. No wonder 9 out of 10 of our business insurance customers renew every year. With agency offices across the UK, we're closer to you, closer to your business, closer to what matters. Search NFU Mutual Builders and Trades Insurance.
I believe those who are curious see the world differently. At Viking, we have always been curious and quite a bit different. For over 25 years, we have been connecting the thinking person with the world. First on the great rivers, then on all 5 oceans, now on all 7 continents. We are One Viking. Exploring the world in comfort.
Listen at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day.
This is Times Radio.
Fee is off this week. She's back on Monday. Oh, Tuesday, actually, of next week. So I'm trying to keep up with your messages. It's much easier when there are two of us, I have to say. But it's just worth saying that we have a message here. A listener says, I suspect, quite honestly, 99% of your listeners will not agree with the views of your guest, Ivan Sampson. Foreign criminals do need to be deported. It is essential for our agency and identity as a country. All right. And others, oh, can I just thank you for the beautiful images that you're sending me of your little slices of paradise? Chris has sent a beautiful image of the Yorkshire Dales. The view from the house, says Chris. You are blessed. And Rachel says, I hope you enjoyed your time in North Berwick. I've been going to visit my grandparents there since I was two. I still regularly go back with my own family. It is a slice of heaven. Do you know what, Rachel? I had a slice of haggis with my Scottish breakfast on Friday. And I'm almost certain I've digested it now, but it was very interesting. I've never had haggis before. Now, the former Blue Peter editor Biddy Baxter has died at the age of 92. She ran the programme for about 26 years, bringing it to audiences of up to 12 million people. We can have a word with Peter Purvis, who presented Blue Peter for more than a decade and worked with Biddy Baxter. Peter, good afternoon to you.
Jane.
What was it like when you first met Biddy Baxter? What was her aura?
Well, I mean, she was such an attractive woman for a start. When I went for my first meeting with her, I mean, one takes in as much as one can. She was very direct, asked very straightforward questions. You were never in any doubt that she knew what she was looking for. I didn't know what she was looking for, but there was no doubt that she knew what she was looking for. And, I mean, she turned out to be the most compelling person. I mean, she was very powerful, but she was also very clever. My first impressions were, I think I can work with this person. As I ended up working with her for 10 and a half years,
yeah.
I think it probably proved the point. We didn't always see eye to eye, but that's, you know, that's water under the bridge. When you're working with people, you don't always. But she was a magnificent producer of a children's programme. She was so innovative. If you think about the things that had not been done on television before, certainly not for children, things like, well, she created the magazine, which is what it was. Small items, 3 or 4 minutes long, not enough time to get bored if you're not interested, and there's always going to be something more interesting coming up with the next item, and so on. She created surrogate pets. Yeah. Something for, at the time, you know, London was becoming high-rise. Lots of people were living in areas where they couldn't keep pets. So Blue Peter kept pets for them, cat, and then a dog, Petra, who I took over when I joined the show, but she was on the programme before me. And it was something which continued right on with the show. She created a format that allowed the show to be as strong as it was for as long as it was. It's a remarkable achievement, if you think about it. She created the appeals that would never leave any child out, because we never asked for money.
No.
We always asked for things that... It was a full recycling programme. We didn't call it recycling then, but that's what it was. So every child could take part. We asked for things that they could all lay their hands on, even if it was the smallest amount. So every child felt that they were involved. And you were talking about North Berwick just a moment ago on the programme. North Berwick has an inshore...
Lifeboat.
Lifeboat.
Yeah.
Provided by Biddy Baxter's imagination. Wonderful appeal that provided for and renewed them and so on. It was remarkable. And yes, as I said, a very, very clever woman.
Yeah.
Having things like makes on the programme, you know, that we would make things out of bits of old rubbish, you know, the old toilet rolls, sticky back plastic and everything else. We weren't allowed to say things like sellotape or... No. Babylon. So we the euphemism for these things was things like sticky back plastic. And the phrase, here's one I made earlier. That came out of that. That was one of Biddy's phrases.
It was a programme of complete genius because it was, as you say, adventurous, but it was also cosy and it was educational. And perhaps for children who didn't have a perfect home life, you could get in from school on Mondays and Thursdays and you had Blue Peter, you had the tortoise. There was a tortoise called Tommy.
Yes, there was.
Was it Tommy? I think he definitely went
no,
into...
No, it was actually Fred.
Fred, that's right. That's right. Yes, you couldn't sex the tortoise. Yes.
Actually, it might be the other way around. I can't remember now.
Someone listening will know.
Yeah. The letter A had to be added on the shell or right. The letter A had to be painted out. I can't remember.
Right. I mean, in so many ways, the programme was ahead of its time. And I can still remember the smell of the milk bottle tops that we all collected for the appeal because they had that slightly cheesy odour which hung around the bottle.
We did that appeal twice, I think. I think the milk tops were done twice and the guide dogs benefited on each occasion.
Yeah. I think it's lovely for me to talk to you because I was one of those people who was nurtured by Blue Peter. And I, at the age of 8, I think I wrote to the programme and I got a letter back. It was signed by Biddy Baxter. And, you know, as a child, you just want to be seen, don't you? And I just felt 6 foot tall when I got that letter. It had such an impact. And there are probably hundreds of thousands of people who had that experience as I did.
She knew that, and she did that quite deliberately. She knew exactly what she was doing. And the correspondence unit kept records of all letters, all of them. And consequently, if you'd written to her again, you would have got you might have got a fairly similar letter, but it would have noted the fact that you'd been spoken to before. I mean, it was very, very intelligently run. It was a big unit, the correspondence unit. So many, I can't remember, thousands of letters a week, and they were all replied to. They were all signed by Biddy Baxter, and they kept records. They knew what they were doing. It was a very cleverly run program, and it meant it for all the right reasons. I'm very proud to have been part of it.
Yeah, well, you should be, because honestly, it was hugely significant in just the lives of so many of us. Peter Purvis, thank you very much indeed for talking.
You're welcome, Jane.
Thank you. Take care of yourself. Talking there about the great Biddy Baxter, who has died at the age of 92. You're listening to Times Radio and it's 2:30. And next, a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State will join us to explain what to expect from the summit between Trump and Putin in Alaska this Friday. Here are the headlines on Times Radio from Andy Hayes.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Good afternoon.
French President Emmanuel Macron says an international coalition under a UN mandate should be used to secure Gaza. He's told BFM TV it would fight terrorism, stabilise the territory and support its population. He is opposing an Israeli military occupation. Palestinians are mourning 5 Al Jazeera journalists, meanwhile, killed in an Israeli strike last night. The Israeli military claims one of them, Anas al-Sharif, was working for Hamas, something the broadcaster denies. The number of prisoners in England and Wales has hit its highest level in almost a year. More than 88,000 are now behind bars. That's up more than 1,200 in the last 2 months. Meanwhile, more foreign criminals will leave the UK before their appeals have been heard as the government expands what it calls its Deport Now, Appeal Later scheme. Home Secretary Yvette Cooper says it'll stop exploitation of the system.
We will go further and we're also making it easier to start the deportation process from the moment of sentencing as well. Because frankly, when people come to the UK, they should abide by the laws and the rules need to be respected and enforced.
And an amber heat health alert has been issued for large parts of England from tomorrow. Temperatures could reach 35 in Celsius, that's 95 in Fahrenheit. The alert covers the East and West Midlands, East Anglia, London and the South East from 9 a.m. And for a roundup of the news on demand, subscribe to the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
When you run a small business, you know it's important to keep an eye on your costs. And a smart meter can help. Barry Henderson is the owner of Henderson's Restaurant in Edinburgh and has been using his smart meter as part of his efforts to waste less energy and be more sustainable.
The smart meter definitely has made us more conscious of our energy use, and we can modify our operation to help just be more efficient. As a vegetarian business, lots of our staff are vegetarian and very environmentally conscious, so using energy efficiently is definitely a key core value for us. It's definitely helped us save money, and it's also helped us be more sustainable, able to focus on where we're using electricity and become more efficient. I genuinely do recommend smart meters to other businesses. Like, I think it just gives you a more accurate picture of how you're using electricity and energy.
To find out more, search Get a Smart Meter for Business. Eligibility may vary.
Get a first look at tomorrow morning's front pages. Tonight from 10 with Carol Walker on Times Radio. This is Times Radio.
Thanks for your messages about the blue beater tortoise. I think I've just looked it up, and originally it was Fred, but then they realised Fred was Frieda. So there we go. All a long time ago, and it won't mean a thing to my young guest, Callum McDonald.
No, I remember Blue Peter fondly.
But you don't remember Fred
or
Frieda.
No. Look,
just be honest. Okay, so Callum is for John Pienaar this week, between 4 and 7. What have you got, Callum?
So we are paying close attention as ever to President Trump, primarily today because he is due to hold a press conference starting any time in the next hour. And this is primarily to announce his real crackdown, his approach to homelessness in Washington, D.C., which we understand is going to involve calling in the National Guard. Yeah, to sort of follow Trump's own words, he's saying, you know, you're not under arrest or anything, but we are going to move you out of the city, homeless people. It's quite a draconian approach, perhaps, to homelessness.
That's one word for it. I should say we are aware of that press conference. We didn't think it was, well, I wasn't allowed to commit to us covering it because the suggestion was always that he's so late.
Yes.
That if I say, oh, yes, we're definitely doing it, it won't happen.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely fair. At some point today, Donald Trump will be speaking. So we will reflect on that. And we expect that he'll take questions, of course, ahead of the Alaska summit on Friday. And really, one of the main themes of our programme today will be, is Donald Trump good for peace? That's the question we'll come on air with, and we'll hear from all sorts of people over the course of the 3 hours after four, from Catherine Philp, the brilliant world affairs editor of the Times, from Tim Marshall, the geopolitical and security and war expert. We'll hear from Ukrainians, we'll hear from Russians. We'll try to understand if Donald Trump is good for peace, and that will run throughout our programme today. I have to say, I've been trying to read quite a lot, as you'd imagine, on this today, and the two schools of thought on this are, it's so difficult to sort of bridge, because one is the thinking that it's great to get Putin in a room and chat to him. The other is that why would you ever do that with somebody who is so dug in to this idea that he wants to conquer Ukraine? And we've heard some of these arguments playing out on Times Radio over the course of the last few days, but we'll try and analyse it just days ahead of this Alaska summit and whether this is a crucial moment, one way or the other, actually, for peace in Ukraine. It could make things a lot worse, I suppose.
Well, it certainly could. It's looking on the bright side.
Yes. That's my glass half empty there. Sorry about that.
Are you any good in the heat, or does it...
Well, I'm wearing shorts.
Well, you were last week as well.
Yeah, it's my childhood in the Highlands and Islands of Scotland means that shorts were quite a rare occurrence. So down here in the deep south, it's quite nice to get the shorts out.
Well, nothing about your childhood prepared you for conditions of over 30 Celsius.
Certainly not. It's very warm.
Crowded London.
I will say, I benefited from an air-conditioned train earlier, and then I got on the Jubilee line, and the heat was like nothing I'd ever experienced, and my core temperature was like some sort of nuclear incident had just happened. It was roasting.
Oh, I'm really looking forward to my journey home. Thanks very much for that, Callum. Terrific. Lynn says, why is the Isle of Man always overlooked when we're talking about Britain? Fabulous coastlines, beautiful crystal clear sea, stunning glens and rivers, mountains, brilliant walks, gorgeous sandy beaches, and nobody tries to fleece you. Very interesting history going back to the Vikings. It's a great place to go at any age, says Lynn, who sounds suspiciously like a representative of the Isle of Man Tourist Board. But I have been to the Isle of Man, Lynn, and you're right. It is absolutely beautiful. Right, it's Times Radio, and we're going to have Robbie Millen, literary editor of The Times and Sunday Times, with us with some, I have to say, some fairly tough literary recommendations. I mean, when I say tough, I mean one in particular is a tough old read, but I think it's apparently a thing of beauty, according to Robbie. So we'll be hearing from him before 3 o'clock this afternoon. First, though, European foreign ministers are meeting today ahead of Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin's summit in Alaska on Friday. Russia is reportedly demanding conditions, including the handover of key Ukrainian cities, to guarantee a ceasefire. The Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, says concessions do not convince a killer and has ruled out any land swap. The foreign policy chief of the EU, Kaja Kallas, has said that the US has the power to force Russia to negotiate seriously. Heather Conley is the former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State under President George W. Bush, and she's able to join us now. Heather Conley, good afternoon from London. Why do you think Putin is getting an invitation to the US? So he, after all, is the aggressor. He invaded another country.
Well, I think this is something that President Trump has wanted for a very long time. A one-on-one meeting with Vladimir Putin. And in many ways, this is the fulfillment of that. And he also is extremely keen to secure a peace deal. Although the president feels, you know, quite confident that he has secured peace between India, Pakistan, Thailand, and Cambodia, what has eluded him are big peace agreements, like between Russia and Ukraine or even in the Middle East. So this is really a fulfillment of something that President Trump has desired for quite some time, even as he began his second term.
But Putin is going to presumably benefit in propaganda terms from a trip to the States. And President Zelensky, as we speak, doesn't have that invitation. Do you think that's likely to change?
So this is absolutely giving Vladimir Putin a complete and utter gift for doing absolutely nothing. There was nothing that the Russians conceded, not even stopping their military action to have this summit. So I just want to underscore, this is a complete and total victory for Vladimir Putin. And the victory, it just becomes sweeter by the exclusion of President Zelensky from these talks. Again, they're recreating a historic moment, the Yalta moment of 1945, when Stalin and Roosevelt with Churchill sat down and carved up Europe. This is the recreation of that in a modern way. This is where the United States and Russia will decide the fate of other European nations by themselves, and they will have to accept it. So it's incredibly destructive, but it's exactly what Vladimir Putin was hoping for.
So this is all about posturing then, and to hell with Ukraine. I mean, is it really as brutal as that?
Well, as I said, I think much is being done in the name of peace and stopping the killing. While those are absolutely laudable goals, and the Ukrainian people would be the very first to say they seek peace and want to stop the killing, this is, I think, in some ways fulfilling President Trump's desire to bring peace. But what he and his administration fail to completely understand, the price of this peace, if it is what's being described as a land swap, they are making lines on maps without Ukraine, without Europe being part of that conversation, it will actually cause greater destabilization. The message here is every country can grab territory if it believes it's in its right or historical place to do so. And we're now bending towards a very different international system. But right now, it's about the summit. It's about the world's attention in Anchorage, Alaska on Friday, and the president coming out and saying he has secured this peace deal.
Right. And the price of that peace deal may very well be paid by the Ukrainian people, who, as we stand at the moment, will not be represented. But it would be reasonable, I think, to point out that if you look at the latest polling in Ukraine, I believe that around about three quarters, about 70% of the Ukrainian population do want the war to end. So what do you say about that?
Well, I think it's absolutely understandable after, a decade of war, beginning in 2014, for the last 3.5 years, they're exhausted and they don't see where it ends. So that is completely understandable. I also think the Ukrainian people do not want a peace foisted upon them. They need to be part of that process. They need to make those decisions. What the United States and Russia are proposing goes against the Ukrainian constitution, as President Zelensky has clearly pointed out. So while there's absolute fatigue, they want a just peace. They need to be at that table. And you're absolutely right. It is completely wrong to not have not only Ukraine at this table deciding its fate, but having, of course, key European nations at that table, because they will be providing much of the security and the assistance for Ukraine to remain a vibrant, sovereign nation in the future.
So what about the fact that European foreign ministers are meeting today? To be blunt about it, they're going to have to get a wiggle on and come up with something pretty quickly, aren't they?
Well, and this has been sort of the painful watching over the last 6 months. It has been Europe attempting to be at that table, catch up, be part of the conversation. And it was incredibly ironic as this statement was coming out about the meeting, the summit meeting between Presidents Putin and Trump in Alaska. Vice President Vance was in the UK meeting with the foreign secretary without their knowledge. This is Europe trying to scramble to support Ukraine and to be at that table. But again, nothing delights Russia more than to divide the United States from its allies, to demonstrate that Europe is weak and cannot be at that table to decide the fate of its future. So I can't begin to tell you the optics of this are so destructive on so many levels.
You sound really very depressed in quite a measured way about all this, if I can put it that way, Heather.
Well, it's hard to be analytical and not extremely emotional. I have spent my professional life being an incredibly strong proponent of the transatlantic relationship, strong Europe, strong United States, and incredibly supportive of Ukraine and its reconstruction. And so, yes, the fact that we are contemplating, the United States is contemplating making this deal with Putin, the aggressor, over the heads of the Ukrainian people, it is a dark moment for the United States. It's a dark moment for the international system. And I hope that a lot of public pressure, and in fact, Vladimir Putin himself, who traditionally pushes too hard, and will do something to prevent this deal from happening. But unfortunately, we are all spectators at what is happening at the moment.
Do you think that Putin has basically played Donald Trump for quite some time now?
Yes, and President Trump has said this out loud multiple times. He's being played. And this is what makes the last several days after Special Envoy Witkoff went to Moscow, it was completely a Russian a victory, a diplomatic victory of having this meeting, agreeing in Alaska, where you just heard Kirill Dmitriev saying, "We're so glad this is being held in, quote, Russian America." I mean, the symbolism is extraordinary here. And they don't even know they're getting played, or they don't care they're getting played, or they don't care that the Russians are winning on every level. So that's why we just are so frustrated right now that they don't understand that they're actually not supporting U.S. strategic interests at this moment.
Really interesting to talk to you, Heather. I hope there's more cause for optimism in the next couple of days. You never know. Thank you very much.
I hope so. Yeah. Let's hope. Thank you.
Well, no, my pleasure to have your company this afternoon. Thank you. Heather Connolly, who's former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State under President George W. Bush. American theme this afternoon, isn't it, really? J.D. Vance, the U.S. Vice President, is, as you know, you must know by now, in the Cotswolds for his summer holidays. The Times' Will Humphreys has been designated official Vance watcher, and I'm told that he's currently amid the Vice President's 19-vehicle convoy. Right, come in, Will. Where are you?
Hi there, Jane. It's the next stop on the cliched Cotswold tour. I'm in Dalesford farm shop.
Are you? Right. Can you pick up a pint of milk for £5, please?
And the rest, yeah.
Oh, right. So, seriously, he's gone to the farm shop?
He has. So there is a private members club at the back of the farm shop. I had a tip this morning from a member saying they'd seen someone in a dark suit in the middle of a hay meadow. So that sort of sent alarm bells off amongst members that there was probably going to be a visit later today. the not so secret service, they should maybe be called. and right on time, sort of this afternoon, the huge fleet of black SUVs have turned up at Daylesford, and they're sort of parked up, engines idling. I've seen Secret Service and British sort of armed special operatives enjoying ice creams and coming out with gift bags as they wait for JD Vance and his wife to sort of sample the delights of Daylesford.
Well, I suppose they've got a few quid, so it shouldn't be too much of a problem for them. In all seriousness, the 19 separate vehicles for a trip to a farm shop, I mean, this is madness, isn't it?
There was a lady beside me, and there's a small crowd formed of sort of Daylesford patrons. Lady in a floppy hat and Dior sunglasses said, "It's not very environmentally friendly." I sort of pointed out to her that's not really on the agenda of the current US administration. But it's a huge amount. He's supposedly the second most powerful man in the world. So, I mean, he travels with a huge amount of security. There are sort of emergency sort of medical units that travel with him, a huge number of US and British sort of armed police or who knows what they are, sort of dressed down in khaki trousers and plaid shirts, not really hiding the Kevlar vests underneath them. He doesn't travel lightly.
Is the weather nice?
It is. It's lovely. It's a sort of light cloud, but it's very warm. The weather's putting on a good show for the Americans. They probably expected drizzle and dampness, but the weather's playing ball at the moment.
Well, that's something. Okay, Will, thank you very much for bringing the Vice President's trip to the Cotswolds to life there with the trip to the, I don't think I need to mention the name of the shop again, but that very, very pricey and exclusive so-called farm shop in the heart of the Cotswolds. That was Will Humphreys reporting. He is our Vance watcher while he's on his holidays here. It's Times Radio, it's 10 to 3, and in a moment we welcome again Robbie Millen for our Monday Literary Salon.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing. With intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture and entertainment. Hear well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6, with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
Download the free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are.
What time is it?
8 a.m. And I've already meditated, stretched, and been for a big run.
How?
It's my new Samsung Galaxy Watch 8 Classic. It's got sleep tracking and bedtime guidance to remind me when to go to bed. So I always wake up early and fresh.
And you made me coffee.
That's mine.
Oh.
Buy the new Galaxy Watch 8 Classic today at Samsung.com. Requires smartphone on Android 11 or above with the latest version of the Samsung Health app, intended for general wellness and fitness purposes only.
To whoever finds this letter, my car broke down. There is nothing nearby. And I've already eaten my meal deal sandwich. Please tell my wife that I love her and that she was right. This jacket isn't waterproof. Signed, Daniel S.
Oh, actually, scrap that. Greenface just arrived. Blimey, less than an hour.
Local rescue, Nationwide. Nothing beats near. Green flag.
On average, we get to breakdowns in under an hour based on app and phone callouts combined between July 24 and June 25.
This is Times Radio.
It is. What are we doing next? Well, we're almost certainly going to talk to Robbie Millen. But I just want to mention this WhatsApp message from Chris. The Cotswolds are in imminent danger, says Chris, of becoming a theme park. The area has been of significant importance since Roman times. You know that, Robbie? And became wealthy during the medieval time because of the sheep farming. Now, during the last 50 years, many of the Roman artefacts, the beautiful mosaic pavements, they've been destroyed. Farms have been concreted over in order to build multiple houses to fill government quotas. Small towns and villages cannot offer enough employment for the people who've bought the houses. So even more fertile farming land has disappeared under a maze of roads, so that people can commute to the larger towns or cities. Dear, we used to be a tranquil area where hard-working farmers added to the nation's prosperity. Now it's partly a dormitory and partly a tourist trap. think Chris is a bit disenchanted.
Yeah,
it does say it sounds that way. I think the heat's getting to quite a few listeners to Times Radio. It's getting to me, if I'm honest. Robbie, you're here with some recommendations. Can we start, first of all, with a book that is really going to interest me, I think, by Lise Doucette?
Oh, yes, yeah. Now, sort of Lise Doucette's one of those, she's the, I think, international correspondent of the BBC or international editor. I mean, she's sort of a bit like Orla Gurin and Lindsay Hilsum. If you see a flash up on the screen, you know, God, something terrible's happening
but
somewhere.
But they're always worth listening to.
Oh, God. Yeah. This book, I've always had a slight prejudice against TV journalists. I've always thought they can't write, but this book's sensational.
Is it?
It's really well written.
Right. I mean,
because what she's doing, it's called The Finest Hotel in Kabul, and it's all about the Intercontinental Hotel there, which apparently all the foreign calls will stay there. And when it opened in the late 60s, it was kind of a very swanky place, because late 1960s, Afghanistan, Mountain Kingdom, very poor, illiterate. But this was a kind of rather sort of hippie scene there, because you had the hippie trail, the hippie tourists going through.
Yeah.
And it was the swinging 60s had reached Kabul, at least in this hotel. So she tells the story of Afghanistan, or more particularly Kabul, through this one hotel. So there's coups, the Marxist coup, the Soviet invasion, the rise of the Mujahideen, the rise of the Taliban, the fall of the Taliban, US. And all the while, this hotel carries on going.
It just keeps going.
The towels are still there.
Right.
But it's one of those things, Afghanistan, I think occasionally one always, you kind of have a fatigue about it. And I think the brilliance of this book is that it kind of humanises it, because she tells the stories of people who have worked there. There's one man that's worked there from sort of the early 70s to only a few years ago. And it just sort of brings to life the place, the country. It's really very good. I was surprised how much I'm enjoying it.
Okay, so this is called The Finest Hotel in Kabul,
yeah.
A People's History of Afghanistan by Lise Doucette.
Yes.
When is it out?
Well, it's out early mid-September. So I slightly pre-book it now. Actually, don't pre-book it, just book it.
Yes. No, do it.
Yes.
I really hope she comes on the programme and Fee and I get a chance to talk to her.
Oh, well, she'll be very good. She'll know how to do it, won't she?
Well, she will know how to do it. I mean, she is a brilliant journalist, and she's also utterly fearless. And I think you're right about Afghanistan. I think too many of us do have a fatigue.
Oh, no, exactly. I'm worried that people, as soon as we mention Afghanistan, they reached for their radios, but hopefully not.
And it is it's always worth saying, it's an utterly nightmarish scenario for over half the population. They can't look out of windows.
No,
women are actually, the most recent edict said that women couldn't look at each other. I mean, it's unbelievable. Women can't go to parks. I mean, it's just, we all ought to be talking about it 24 hours a day, but we're not, unfortunately. But that does sound like an incredibly good book.
Yeah, thank you. It's really good, really good.
All right, thank you, and congratulations to Lise, who's got another string to her bow. Now, Flesh is a novel by David, you'll have to tell me how to pronounce.
Well, I'm going to go with Saloy.
Okay.
Shall we spell it?
Yes, S-Z-A-L-A-Y.
Yeah, he's a British-Hungarian author, so I assume the Saloy bit is more Hungarian bit.
Yeah.
And a couple of weeks ago, this was longlisted for the Booker Prize, which is why I picked it up and was been reading at the weekend. And it's, again, it wasn't necessarily a book I would gravitate towards. David Saloy's got a very good reputation as a literary novelist. Mm-hmm. But this is a story of István, who is just a Hungarian bloke. And we follow him through various phases of his life, from teenage years in this kind of small, unnamed town in Hungary. He spends some time in a youth offenders institution, time in the army. And you know how there's kind of you can tell a 21st century novel because there's loads of dialogue in it. Everything proceeds by a dialogue. You think Sally Rooney, everyone's always talking. He's managed to pull off an amazing trick of making dialogue, but the man is essentially monosyllabic.
Yeah, I mean, I gather that he is a rather, I think, taciturn.
Taciturn's the posh word.
Yeah, it's the adjective applied to this person. And he doesn't really change.
No, he does. The sort of most conversations go, are you all right, Isfam? Yeah. Do you want to talk about it? No.
So he's not a hero?
He's just a protagonist, the main character. And it's really just a story of a man. And it's really quite amazing how, given we got this guy who's taciturn, monosyllabic, whatever we want to call him, he doesn't have much conversation. He would not be a very good Times Radio presenter. Yet, nonetheless, we kind of get entry to his world. And it's just, I love it when novelists... Why the hell would I be interested in this man? There's absolutely no reason other than this David Soloy has got this talent for making you interested. That's what I love about fiction.
Well, people, this is an awards book, isn't it, this one?
It is. I wouldn't surprise me if it won the Booker.
Okay.
There we go. I've doomed it now.
Well, it's one of those books that you can sort of have in your possession and sort of flash it about.
Yeah,
so have you read Flesh?
Exactly. A name like Soloy, it kind of immediately makes it look 10% more sort of intellectual.
Now, the final book, it's a recommendation from you that I have to say, when I read about this, I just thought, don't know, will I ever want to read something like it? It's by a woman who's, she's the professor of creative writing at Princeton.
Yeah.
But tell us her story, because it is shattering.
Oh, yeah. It's called Things in Nature Merely Grow, and she's called Yiyun Lee. And she lost two of her sons in their teenage years to suicide. One was 16, and then the second son, a few years later, died aged 19, both by their own hand. And it's really about trying to make sense of that terrible thing. And, I mean, it's very heavy duty, but the writing is so candid and clear. And it's so surprising because it's not one of the things she says to her students when they have to do a scene with tragedy. They want people rending their garments and screaming and crying out loud. And that wasn't her experience of these two terrible things. So it's really about what she calls radical acceptance. She says, I live in the abyss because this terrible thing has happened to me twice. Mm. And there's nothing I can do to change this terrible thing. My new reality is living in this abyss, and it's about how you do it. And it's not a book I would normally gravitate towards, but it's such a powerful read. And there's not an ounce of false sentimentality. It's the ability to be so candid, yet not ask for your approval, or she's not trying to sort of make you cry or anything like that. She's just trying to explain how it is for her.
Yes, I read a little bit about this book and people have asked her, not surprisingly, was it cathartic to write the book? Yeah. She says no. You know, it's still absolutely awful, but I have written a book about it.
I mean, in a weird way, there is some sort of solace reading it because, one, it's a reminder of how much we can cope with, but she sort of shows that, I don't know, there's some sort of peace has been made. It's not a lovely piece, but there's something very... I just think anyone that can be so candid is... It's just an incredibly admirable book. I don't know whether this is a kind of book that people who've gone through a terrible thing like that themselves should read or not read. I think probably people would benefit from reading it.
Robbie, thank you. It's a book called In Nature Things Merely Grow by Yiyun Lee.
Yeah.
That's right, isn't it? And is that out now?
That's out now, yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Robbie, very much. It's almost 3:00.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Good afternoon, this is Jane Garvey on Times Radio. In the next hour, why are there so many HMOs, Houses of Multiple Occupation, for migrants in and around Bolton? We'll talk about that in the next hour. And my guest is Abigail Leonard, author of a book called Four Mothers, A Year in Motherhood Around the World. That's Abigail Leonard with me after 3:30. Let's get the news at 3. Here's Andy Hayes.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. French President Emmanuel Macron says an international coalition under a UN mandate should be set up to secure Gaza. He's told BFM TV it would fight terrorism, stabilise the territory and support its population. He is opposing an Israeli military occupation. Israel, meanwhile, claims an Al Jazeera journalist killed in an airstrike in Gaza was working for Hamas, something the broadcaster denies. Anas al-Sharif was among five colleagues who died near a hospital in the overnight attack. Times correspondent Gabriel Varnica says Israel claims he was a military target.
They accuse him of being the head of a terrorist cell in the Hamas organization, and they say he's responsible for advancing rocket attacks against Israeli civilians and troops. They say that they have intelligence information, including documents that confirm that he was affiliated with Hamas. We haven't seen those documents yet, but I'm waiting on having a look at those.
Three teenagers aged 14, 15 and 16 have been arrested on suspicion of murder on the Isle of Sheppey in Kent. Police were called to Lays Down on Sea late last night. A man in his 40s was confirmed dead at the scene. A girl and two boys remain in custody. The number of prisoners in England and Wales has hit its highest level in almost a year. More than 88,000 are now behind bars. That's up more than 1,200 in the last 2 months, despite thousands of inmates being freed early. In football, Crystal Palace have lost an appeal after being demoted from the coming season's Europa League. They went to the Court of Arbitration for Sport after UEFA ruled they had breached multi-club ownership rules. They'll now be in the Conference League instead. The former editor of Blue Peter, Biddy Baxter, has died at the age of 92. She ran the programme for more than 20 years, achieving audiences of up to 12 million. Peter Purvis presented Blue Peter for more than a decade and worked with Biddy Baxter. He says the programme was very well run and every child who wrote in got a reply.
It was a big unit, the correspondence unit. So many, I can't remember, thousands of letters a week. And they were all replied to. They were all signed by Biddy Baxter. They kept records. They knew what they were doing. It was a very cleverly run programme and it meant it for all the right reasons. I'm very proud to have been part of it.
And an amber heat health alert has been issued for large parts of England from tomorrow. Temperatures could reach 35 in Celsius, 95 in Fahrenheit. The alert covers the East and West Midlands, East Anglia, London and the South East from 9 a.m. For people cooling off on the coast, Ross McLeod from the RNLI is asking people to remember call, tell, throw if they get into trouble.
First off, call 999. Then you're telling that person in the water to float, so to flip onto their back to stay as calm as possible. And the third one is to throw. And that's to throw them something buoyant, anything with air in it, so a football or a drinks bottle with a cap on it, something like that, that the person can grab onto, keep themselves afloat a little bit easier.
And for a roundup of the news on demand, find the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Good afternoon, this is Jane Garvey on Times Radio until 4 o'clock. Now, you might well have seen in the Times today reports that the number of residences in Bolton that have been turned into HMOs, houses of multiple occupancy for asylum seekers, have risen from about 170 to 720 in recent years. This is according to data from the local authority there. This is the voice of Sarah Pochin. She's the Reform MP for Runcorn and Helsby. And here she is speaking at a press conference earlier today.
All of these people are either checked into hotels or dispersed into houses of multiple occupancy, better known as HMOs, around the country. And there's disturbing news today in the press about how the Home Office are liaising with private contractors to sweep up whole streets of houses, to take over blocks of houses.
That was Sarah Pochin, the Reform MP. Let's bring in here David Grant, independent local councillor at Bolton County Council, who is backing a group called Say No to HMOs Horwich, a campaign group that's urging Bolton Council to require all new HMOs to get planning permission. Mr Grant, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Jane. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, it's really going to be interesting, I hope, anyway, and enlightening for me, certainly, to talk to you. How long have you been aware of the increase in the number of HMOs in your part of Bolton?
Directly. It came to light locally through residents' concerns of a number of properties next door to them, nearby, being converted from family dwellings pretty much overnight into HMOs. This has happened to three properties in one particular area around about November. And when we started the journey to try and get an Article 4 directive, I was quite concerned at the sheer numbers. I think you mentioned it at the top of your show there. It's gone from 170 to 720.
I've got to just pick you up on the Article 4 directive. What's that?
So currently, developers or property owners can convert any property up to six bedrooms without any planning permission whatsoever. It's under permitted development rights. And Article 4 removes those permitted development rights, which means that the public and the community actually now get a say on all conversions.
Right. And your best guess, I would imagine, is that if the public had had a say, they wouldn't have wanted so many conversions.
No, absolutely not. It changes the fabric of a community. If you could imagine, family dwellings, and this has happened to one of the properties, if you're offering a landlord £3,000 for housing six residents in one property, as opposed to £700 for housing a family, then the landlord is clearly going to go for the more viable option in terms of finances. And that also comes, particularly if you're dealing with Serco contracts, that means that Serco takes that property off their hands for 5 years. So the landlord has no responsibilities and no liabilities. The people in those properties effectively become a commodity.
Right, just to, you better also just say exactly what Serco do. They're a company that, they're a private company, aren't they, that get lots and lots of government contracts to transport prisoners, for example.
Yeah, in this instance, they are facilitating what's called Operation Scatter, for want of a better name. That's what it's called.
Who calls it that?
That's the government's name for it, Operation Scatter.
And it does. What is Operation Scatter then?
It's basically the removal of asylum seekers from hotels out into the community.
Right. Okay, well, I'm quite surprised that it's called Operation Scatter, but I suppose they've got to call it something. Right, well, you mentioned the fact that people, I mean, let's be honest, lots of taxpayers resent asylum seekers being in hotels. So they are moved out of these relatively expensive hotels and into accommodation like this. Yeah. This saves us, the taxpayer, some money, doesn't it?
It does. I've not seen the exact figures that. But again, I want to stress and emphasise, Say No to HMO Horwich and myself aren't actually campaigning against the housing of migrants. What we're trying to campaign against is the proliferation in very small areas of HMOs, which are being facilitated by Serco. The residents of the group and myself have no issue with, as Angela Rayner says, taking our fair share. Mm. But instead of putting one, for instance, in Horwich, then putting one over in Bury and one in Manchester, what seems to be happening is a coordinated campaign to get as many into an area as possible until they hit a government target of up to 1% of the local population, and then they move on to another area.
Where have you got that figure of up to 1% from?
That was in a briefing that I had at Bolton Council with Serco themselves.
So Serco have said in a paper given to the council that it's their policy, presumably as instructed by the government, to deposit asylum seekers in populations up to 1% of the population.
Yes.
Right. And so there must be many other parts of the country that have similarly been impacted then?
There are, and there's lots of other areas. Wigan, our adjoining borough, is desperately trying to get an Article 4 direction put through. And other areas have been a bit ahead of us. Salford, for instance, have already had one for a number of years. It doesn't stop HMOs, but it does give the public a better say. If it still meets planning criteria, then there's no stopping it happening. However, at least residents get a say in how their communities develop.
You have to say, I'm not a landlord. If I were a landlord in this part of the world, though, as you've already illustrated, I'd be rather attracted by this as a proposition, because I've got the dosh rolling in and I have almost no responsibility. Have you spoken to landlords?
On and off, yeah. Some of them are being pushed into this route purely because of government legislation on the Renters Reform Bill, which gives, quite rightly, more responsibilities to landlords to look after and protect their tenants. But by going through the Serco route, they can go, there's my property, thank you for £36,000 a year, and walk away for 5 years and not have to deal with that responsibility. But I just want to get on. It's the unintended consequences of this policy that the residents that I represent are concerned about. So the unintended consequences are, if landlords are tempted to convert family homes into HMOs, that means housing stock for families is fewer, which means the cost to rent a family home goes up.
Goes up, yeah.
People can't then afford that family home, so they move out of the area, completely changing the fabric of that community and that community cohesion.
Right. I mean, I absolutely understand that. And I wonder if you could point us to any actual instances of problems on the ground caused by these HMOs.
So locally, we've had drug dealing, litter, and antisocial behaviour. It's not got to anywhere near the extent that you see on the news in some areas. But it's just, and for the residents of living next door to these HMO conversions, what you've got to remember is what used to be an adjoining bedroom, so a children's bedroom next to another children's bedroom, is now that person's living space. So the noise can go on to the early hours, keeping residents up at night. Because obviously we are on a particular cycle. We've got to bed at 9, 10, 11 o'clock at night. Mm-hmm. And some of these migrants perhaps might want to be contacting back home sometimes in the early hours in the morning. It's their living space, so they've got TV on, they're shouting, talking on the telephone, etc. So it creates disturbance. And without planning permission, where residents and councillors can get a say on requirements to soundproof and things like that, it really affects the community.
Yeah, I can understand that. Let me just bring you some comments from listeners, if you don't mind. What's this? The government should be housing our own homeless. This is Cole. You can bet your life you won't see these people being housed next door to multimillionaires in the Cotswolds. And Stevie says, Jane's clearly not bothered about HMOs in the north of England. Shut up and put up, working class, would be her line of thinking, says Stevie. Right, well, I mean, that's Stevie's observation. I'm from the north of England, for what it's worth, so I'm sure it is of concern to many people there. What about that, the fact that Cole's point, why put these people in a place like Horwich?
Well, and that's the concern. I mean, if I've got a copy of the leaflet from Bolton Council that they hand to the migrants that come to Horwich, and it lists all the organisations that are there to help them, and there's none in Horwich directly. The nearest help or information for these residents who've moved into these HMOs is all in Bolton, 8 miles away. There is no services, no facilities, nothing for them here. It's just that landlords have been willing to sell their property or lease their property to Serco.
Right. So the problem, I mean, it does come back to the landlords, doesn't it? And I'm not saying I blame them, because they want to make a living like we all do. But if they stopped succumbing to the advances of, I don't know, the local authority or the government or Serco, then this wouldn't be an issue for Horwich. But it would be an issue for somewhere else, wouldn't it?
It absolutely would. And the whole system, it's not about migration. The whole system of asylum is broken. I think we can all agree on that. And it's been broken for so long that there's no easy fix. And what I think the government themselves need to do is completely rehash the system. I know they've started with one in, one out, but they're still coming in. But it shouldn't be about that. It should be about maintaining the integrity of our communities, particularly up in the north where we are. It should be ensuring that community cohesion exists. And landlords, absolutely, as you say, are part of the problem. But sometimes they tend to be landlords that don't live in the area.
Right. I mean, would that be the majority of the landlords involved here?
I'd certainly say a lot of them, yes.
Right. Interesting. Okay. Really, really good to talk to you, David. I appreciate you giving up your time. That's David Grant, who's an independent local councillor at Bolton County Council. And he's been helping out with that group in Horwich near Bolton. Coming up after 3:30, I'm going to be talking to the journalist and writer Abigail Leonard. She's written a book about parenthood, specifically motherhood, actually, in 4 very different countries. One is Kenya, one is Japan, one is the USA, and the other is Finland. All the babies she follows in the book were born in 2022. What were their first 12 months like? We'll talk to Abigail after 3:30 this afternoon. Every week on the programme, you can catch up with our big, big guests after 3:30 on the Off Air with Jane and Fee podcast, which comes your way Monday to Thursday on all good podcast outlets at around 6 o'clock. Actually, I'm doing it this week with Jane Mulkerins, who is always a brilliant contributor. So it's Garvey and Mulkerins on Off Air this week. The pod, though, will feature all our 3:30 interviews in full. And we've had some crackers recently, Max Hastings, Janet Street Porter, and recently Fee talked to Gary Newman. He told her why he's glad social media wasn't around when he was really famous.
Social media is 90% evil. I mean, it's just an awful burden on all of us. I wish it wasn't there.
Do you think it can connect you to your fans?
If you mentioned anything on social media about anything, you could say the nicest thing and then somebody will find a problem with it. You know, I don't even have feedback on my social media anymore. It's all turned off. No comments. Don't want to hear. There's too many idiots out there. Too many weird people that just feel they've got to say something horrible. So no, I'm glad it happened when it happened, and I didn't have to have the whole social media thing falling on your shoulders. I sympathise with people today. How many people have killed themselves? They've got a little bit successful. You know, they've been on one of these reality TV shows or something, and suddenly the onslaught of people descends upon them and they go to ruin.
That's the brilliant Gary Newman talking to Fee on Off Air a couple of weeks ago now. But there are so many editions of Off Air you can enjoy or endure, depending on your view of things. But it's fun to do. We like doing it. And it drops at 6 o'clock Monday to Thursday. You can also find it, of course, on the Times Radio app. Right, it's now 18 minutes past three. Crowds have gathered at the funerals of five Al Jazeera journalists killed in a targeted Israeli airstrike in Gaza last night. Anas al-Sharif and four others working for the media outlet's Gaza City team died in this attack, condemned as an assassination by their employer. The Israeli Defence Forces claim that Mr. al-Sharif was actually a member of a Hamas terror cell. Sarah Kuda is the Middle East Director for the Committee to Protect Journalists. Sarah, this is a very grim day, isn't it?
It's a horrible day. It's a nightmare, to be honest.
How did you and when did you find out about this?
I found out last night in my time. It was around 10 minutes after Anas was killed with his colleagues. And we immediately tried to get something out to inform that he was killed, he was targeted, and his colleagues were targeted as well.
Can you tell me a little bit about what it is like for journalists to operate in Gaza? Because we certainly know that we can't, the Times cannot send its own representatives to Gaza, nor can other major British news organisations. How were these people able to work there and under what sort of conditions?
Yes, of course. So as you all know, all international media were banned from going inside Gaza. And this is something that adds more to the catastrophe. Journalists inside Gaza are working under starvation, fear of their life, their fear of the killing of their families. They are working under a lot of horrible conditions where they have to juggle between the safety of themselves, their families, but also report on what is happening in Gaza. This is not easy. They are reporting on their families who are being killed. They are reporting on their fellow key colleagues who are being killed. They are deprived from aid, medical aid, safe and protection in general, and the ability to leave the country. So this adds to it. In addition to that, they have been witnessing in several times disconnectivity, unable to report safely and freely, being attacked and harassed. So you can imagine the conditions. A few weeks ago, the Committee to Protect Journalists reached out to a few journalists. We are constantly in communication with journalists on the ground. But a few weeks ago, we reached out to a few journalists. We asked them to document in voice and picture the conditions they are reporting through. And through a campaign, we called it Voices from Gaza, they told us about the horrific conditions they are witnessing. And it was heartbreaking, to be honest, because we stand here unable to do anything to them except of reporting.
I have got an account here of a message that Anas al-Sharif posted. He wrote this in the event that he was killed. And he says, "I never hesitated to convey the truth as it is without distortion or misrepresentation, hoping that God would witness those who remain silent." Those words are very moving, particularly obviously in the light of his death. And you wonder whether many Palestinian journalists feel that actually their deaths are, if not quite inevitable, then certainly quite likely.
Of course. They live on this fear and this anticipation day by day. So they know that their day is coming and they will be targeted and killed, if not today, tomorrow. But so they do feel this fear.
Is it not possible, Sarah, that in fact some, we know that some journalists, many journalists, unfortunately, have lost their lives in the fighting. Surely some of them could have been killed by Hamas. If they were not reporting what Hamas wanted, then they will have been vulnerable to Hamas violence as well.
Of course, we are not defending Hamas over Israel or Israel over Hamas. This is not what we are doing. We are defending the safety of all journalists, whether they are being attacked from Hamas or from Israel. The Committee to Protect Journalists, we have reported several times in the past few months about the harassment that is happening towards Palestinian journalists in Gaza who are reporting against Hamas. So this is something that is happening. But you can, we also need to look at the power dynamics here. You can't compare Hamas to Israel. You can't, in terms of power, in terms of military equipment and all of that. So if Hamas, if and only if, it was confirmed that they killed one journalist, in return, Israel has killed nearly 200 journalists. So you can imagine, sorry, did I lose you?
No, I can still hear you, Sarah. Carry
on. Okay, sorry. I'm so sorry. I think I thought I lost my connection.
Don't worry.
So you can't really compare what Hamas is doing to what Israel is doing.
No.
But this is not the case. And especially not in the case of Anas al-Sharif and his fellows, where an entire crew was wiped in minutes.
Yes. So I just need to put to you, though, the suggestion, certainly from Israel, and we've heard it here ourselves on Times Radio, that Anas al-Sharif was a member of Hamas. What do you say to that?
So Anas al-Sharif, Israel did not provide any proofs that Anas al-Sharif is a member of Hamas. If Anas al-Sharif was working with a media outlet that is affiliated with Hamas, that does not at all justify killing him. So he was not doing any military actions. He did not hold a weapon. He was not working with Hamas. Working with a media outlet that is affiliated with a certain group or country does not mean that they are terrorists and they should be killed. This is something that we have to differentiate, because sometimes you find yourself in a position where you are working with a government-affiliated media outlet, and this government is considered to be a terrorist. Would you be a terrorist? No, you are not. You should not be killed because you are doing your job.
Thank you very much for your time this afternoon, Sarah Akuda, who is the Middle East Director for the Committee to Protect Journalists. Let's talk to Nick Maynard, a British surgeon who has got back from Gaza pretty recently. He has been treating victims of the fighting there. Nick Maynard, when did you get back?
Just over 2 weeks ago, 2.5 weeks ago, I returned. I'd spent 4 weeks at Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis.
Right. And frankly, what was it like?
It was awful. I mean, it was my third trip out to Gaza since October the 7th, 2023. And each time I go, I think I'm going to be prepared for what I'm going to see. But each time I'm not prepared, and it's much worse than I expected. So on this occasion, it was really quite horrific, indescribably so. The malnutrition, the multiple deaths I saw in babies, children, adults from malnutrition, the multiple shootings of young teenage boys at the food distribution points. I saw absolute horrors there, the like of which I would never have imagined I would see in a civilised world.
Is there any way that these food distribution centres are now slightly safer, better organised? Because there just weren't very many of them. I gather there had been hundreds of places where you could get food, and all of a sudden there were only four, I think.
Yeah, there used to be 400 food distribution points when it was run by UNRWA and other agencies, and the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation sites, there were four of them. I mean, clearly the number was utterly inadequate, but it wasn't just the number, it was the way they were set up. They were described by everyone I know who went to them as death traps. They were designed to create chaos, rioting, And of course, there were multiple teenage boys who were being shot at by Israeli soldiers and by the quadcopter drones, many of whom I operated on.
OK, you say shot at. I mean, I think we have to be careful here. I mean, you're absolutely certain that from your perspective, they were targeted.
Well, I saw and operated every day on these patients for 4 weeks. I saw multiple examples, and all the other surgeons saw multiple examples, and all the ER doctors, of clustering of gunshot wounds on particular body parts on particular days. So one day they'd all be coming in with gunshot wounds to the head or the neck, the next day to the chest, the next day to the abdomen, the next day to the legs. On one day we had four young teenage boys come in, all of whom had been shot in the testicles. So yes, I didn't go to these food distribution points, but I saw multiple victims. I heard multiple descriptions of what was going on from victims, from families, and indeed Gazan healthcare colleagues who went to these food distribution points. The clustering, the patterns we saw were far too striking to be coincidental. So the only explanation I have been able to think of is that they were being used almost as a game of target practice.
Well, I mean, we don't have a representative of the Israeli government or the IDF on air with us at the moment, but I hear what you've said, Nick, and thank you for that. Let's talk about the idea that Netanyahu's government is apparently intent on pushing into Gaza City. What, based on your experience, would be the impact on the Palestinian population?
I mean, I'm not surprised to hear this. It's what I think many people and those of us who've been out there have seen for some time as Netanyahu's end game. It'll be catastrophic. There have been so many thousands of deaths now. It'll lead to far more deaths. The malnutrition is so severe now that even if there were enough food going in today, there'd be many thousands more of deaths, I'm quite sure. And if he carries out his threat, they will all be displaced further south. There is no room in the south at all for these people. It'll only lead to vastly more overcrowding, vastly more malnutrition, and very, very many more deaths.
And do you see any change in terms of the Israeli government policy? I appreciate you're not a member of the Israeli government, far from it, but do you detect any possible impact of Israeli public opinion on what the Israeli government seems intent on carrying out?
Well, one can hope, and one certainly sees a change in public opinion. You can see a change in rhetoric coming from our government. But unless these are accompanied by actions, then and indeed the actions being taken by the Netanyahu government seem to be getting worse and worse. So I see no indication that they are going to rein back from these plans.
Are you likely to go back?
Most certainly. I go regularly, so I'll certainly go back in a few months' time.
Nick Maynard, British surgeon, thank you very much for your time this afternoon. It is Times Radio, and next, the author Abigail Leonard will discuss her book Four Mothers, A Year in Motherhood Around the World. Let's check in on the newsroom just after 3:30. Here are the headlines, Andy Hayes.
Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6 on Times Radio.
Stig's off to Edinburgh to the book festival, so Alexis Conran will be here with me presenting. We'll speak to Britain's first and only female 3 Michelin star chef. The former Scottish Labour leader Kezia Dugdale will be joined by the former Conservative Justice Secretary Alex Chalk to talk through the day's news, and we will ask how much you have to advocate for your own healthcare.
Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6 on Times Radio.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Good afternoon, this is Andy Hayes with the news headlines. French President Emmanuel Macron says an international coalition under a UN mandate should be set up to secure Gaza. He's told BFM TV it would fight terrorism, stabilise the territory and support its population. He is opposing an Israeli military occupation. Israel, meanwhile, claims an Al Jazeera journalist killed in an airstrike in Gaza was working for Hamas, something the broadcaster denies. 3 teenagers aged 14, 15 and 16 have been arrested on suspicion of murder on the Isle of Sheppey in Kent. Police were called to Lays Down on Sea late last night. A man in his 40s was confirmed dead at the scene. A girl and 2 boys remain in custody. And criminals from almost two dozen countries will no longer be able to delay their deportation by appealing against the decision to remove them. Under a Deport Now, Appeal Later initiative, foreign citizens from countries including India, Kenya and Uganda who've been convicted of crimes in the UK will lose the right to stay while they challenge the decision to remove them. Ivan Sampson, head of immigration policy at Privatus Law, has told Times Radio it's an outrageous policy.
There is no appeal rights. So if you have been living here since childhood and you've got family and entrenched life here and you've rehabilitated from coming out of prison and you've served your time, then you get sent back to a country you have absolutely no connection to. That is unjust, unfair, unreasonable and disproportionate.
And you can hear detailed analysis of the biggest developments in global security on our World in 10 podcast.
This is Times Radio.
How are you looking so fresh?
It's my new Samsung Galaxy Watch 8. It's got this thing called Running Coach, which creates custom training plans just for me. Oh, and that's our cue to pick up the pace.
What? This isn't fast enough. Oh.
Smash your fitness goals with a new Galaxy Watch 8. Buy today at Samsung.com. Requires smartphone on Android 11 or above with the latest version of the Samsung Health app.
Ah, claim approved. Direct Line's ready to send my new laptop within 2 hours. That's how it's done. Imagine if that's how everything got done. Like teaching little Johnny to play his recorder.
Oh, my. That's my boy!
Direct Line. That's how it's done.
Theft and accidental loss claims up to £3,000. Cover limits apply. Personal possessions cover needed for items outside the home.
Thanks to a blend of petrol and electric, fill up less this summer with the self-charging Mazda 2 Hybrid Centerline. It's available to finance for £199 per month with 0% APR representative. To go further for less this summer, search Mazda 2 Hybrid. Mazda Financial Services, PCP over 48 months, deposit of 5395, optional final payment of 9833. Indemnities may be required, terms apply, see website.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
25 minutes to four. We have got some brilliant guests actually on the programme this week. Tomorrow, it's the actress and novelist Celia Imrie. Nicola Sturgeon, who's written a memoir about her life and times. It's called Frankly. And she's on the programme on Wednesday. And then on Thursday, it's the crime writer Val McDermid. So lots to sink your teeth into during the course of this week here on Times Radio Afternoons. This afternoon, though, I'm going to talk to Abigail Leonard. Now, she is a journalist who has lived and worked all over the world. And she had the first of her three children when she was living in Japan. And she's written a book called Four Mothers, A Year in Motherhood Around the World. And the locations she features in this book are Finland, Kenya and the USA, as well as Japan. So, Abigail, I think this is such a good idea, this book. How did it come to you?
Thank you. So I came to this idea, actually, as you mentioned, I had my own children in Japan, and it was, you know, a really different experience, a really challenging experience to have children in a country that's not your own. But there were a lot of support systems that Japan had that I really noticed were absent when I came back to the US. And so I just started thinking about how sort of the daily sort of grind of parenthood and the daily joys are really shaped by where you have children and sort of the policies of that place.
Yeah, I think it's just worth saying without terrifying people who are 8 months pregnant that there is more grind than joy to start with, isn't there? Is that reasonable?
In my case, that was true.
Okay.
That's yes.
All right. I hadn't realised you had all of your children in Japan, so that's really interesting. So you picked four women in four very different countries. Why did you pick Japan, Finland, Kenya and the States?
You know, I was in Japan, so I sort of understood that culture. And there was such an interesting culture there of families, but also it was difficult for women, I think, in general, to sort of, you know, have both careers and be successful mothers. There was just sort of too much expected of mothers in a way. So I just found that culture really interesting. And also because they're talking so much about how to, you know, increase the birth rate there. There's a lot of political attention on it, but it doesn't seem to actually be working. So, like, why is that? The U.S., you know, obviously I'm from here, and I think it's pretty well documented that, you know, we have a pretty flimsy, you know, social safety net for mothers and parents and families in general. So I wanted to examine that. Finland, you know, and the Nordic countries are sort of held up as this example of how to do it right in some ways. And I wanted to understand whether that was true sort of day to day, and also why that was true, sort of the history of that. And Kenya, I mean, it's just, I wanted to sort of be geographically representative, but Kenya also has this really long tradition of taking care of new mothers. There are sort of traditional ways of doing that, but they're fading as modern systems replace them, and there's sort of not a lot there anymore to take care of moms. So I just wanted to get a sense of what was happening around the world and how, you know, really how it could be made better for women sort of everywhere.
I do think it's absolutely fascinating. Can we start by talking about Japan? They do have a real problem with their birth rate. And in fact, I think last year in the country, there were 1 million more deaths than births. So they are really up against it, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. And you can feel it when you're there. I mean, I did this trip, and one of my trips, I went to Japan sort of right before I went to Kenya. And you could feel even on the trains, it was like, if I came back in, you know, 20 years, probably some large percentage of these people won't be here. You know, it just feels very old when you're there. And then in Kenya, it's so dynamic and young, and you just get this sense being on the ground that they're different, and that Japan is such an aging society. And they're sort of continual. I mean, I was working as a journalist there, and I felt like so much of what I was covering was the government's attempts to get women to have more kids. There felt like there was this ticking clock, and once you passed it, like, they were going to go off a cliff, and that was it. And, you know, so there were ways that it was made easier, and there were all sorts of support, universal daycare, all of these things. But as I said, the culture and sort of the difficulty of just sort of existing as a woman in some ways makes it hard to have as many kids, I think, as many people would like.
Right. I mean, it's just also worth saying, I really didn't know this, that pain relief in labour in Japan is, well, it's not forbidden, but it's not in any way encouraged, is it?
It's not encouraged, and it's also not accessible for a lot of women. So, you know, most hospitals don't have pain relief offered. And if they do, it's often only during business hours that they have people able to administer it. And so most babies come at night. So it just really is sort of not a thing there. And partly this is because there's this cultural idea that pain bonds the mother and child. And so if you sort of endure this pain, it allows you to, I don't know, sort of create this bond with your child. And that idea persists through, you know, all of child rearing in some ways, that the mom is supposed to sacrifice in order to make sure that the child is doing well. And that really shapes the experience there. So yeah, I mean, I was actually also surprised when I moved there at 7 months pregnant that this was the case. But yeah, it's interesting. It's changing. I mean, there are these surveys that show that Japanese women, you know, would like to have more pain relief. And I think more of it is happening slowly, but it's really, yeah, it's fascinating.
You also feature, well, we should go through the women, actually. It's in Japan, the mother you focus on is called Tsukasa. I hope I've pronounced that right. Yeah. Chelsea in Kenya, Anna in Finland, Sarah in Utah in the US. Chelsea in Kenya, I really, really felt sorry for Chelsea. She was incredibly up against it, couldn't afford an epidural. I think she was quoted $300 to have an epidural during her labour. And she didn't have a father in the mix either, or at least not one able to support her. It just sounded properly tough for her.
Yeah, it was really hard for her. I mean, it's true. Sort of during labour, she was negotiating, trying to get this pain relief. And, it, you know, she finally resigns herself to it's not going to happen, and she has to go through this difficult birth. And, you know, yeah, in some ways, her entire experience of that first year was really hard. It was interesting to compare her experience to that of her grandmother's and that of another woman who was, you know, this 91-year-old woman I spoke to who had a really positive postpartum experience because people from the community came and sort of cared for her. But as I said, a lot of those traditions are fading. So Chelsea had very, very few of those. And as you mentioned, the father of her child was pretty uninvolved. And because Chelsea had a remote relationship with her own dad. She didn't want to push the father of her child any further away than he already was. So she was sort of going through all of this stuff. And what resulted was, it was, you know, she had a lot of anxiety, just sort of the day to day. So she would be constantly like monitoring her baby's weight, all this stuff. It just felt like all the sort of difficulty she was having in motherhood. She was trying to control what she could, and it produced a lot of anxiety in her.
Yes. How did you find the women that you focused on?
The women in the U.S., I actually went into mothers groups, online mothers groups, and asked sort of if anyone would be interested in doing this. And I spoke to a lot of women, and I found Sarah to be the most sort of representative as a middle-class American teacher kind of a thing. But the others, I worked with local reporters, and I had very specific parameters for what I wanted. Like, I wanted a woman having a baby in January 2022, first baby, you know, middle-class woman.
Yeah.
Urban environment. And so they were able to find them for me, which was incredible. So yeah, local reporters.
And Finland, like you, I might have expected that that would be a kind of Nordic paradise, but it wasn't entirely plain sailing for the young woman, Anna, in Finland either.
No, it wasn't. I mean, she was set up a lot better, obviously, than the other women. You know, she went to the public health clinic for her birth and, you know, pretty much had what she wanted. You know, she had some pain relief. She was able to stay a couple of days after that sort of stuff. And then the public health nurse was really great when she was having trouble breastfeeding. But as far as her sort of personal relationship, I mean, she wasn't married to the father of her child, and their relationship, you know, became challenging pretty quickly. And it was partly because he sort of wasn't on board with the egalitarian way that she envisioned parenthood going. He wasn't raised in Finland. And so, yeah, they got into just a lot of sort of difficulty. And then it, you know, made that first year really hard. But on the other hand, she was able to get out of that relationship. She was able to, you know, be a mother sort of the way she wanted to be and sort of pursue motherhood, because she had all this support from the government, from the, you know, the public health sector was really there for her. And so in the end, she, you know, was pretty happy with sort of how things turned out overall, that she felt supported.
Do you have, I mean, based on, I'm sure you've answered this question a million times, but based on what you discovered, which of the countries would have been the best place to have a baby, do you think?
I mean, I do think, you know, Finland has some really wonderful supports. And so as far as that goes, I think, you know, that's probably the best place in some ways to have a baby. My sort of aim for this was to think about, because I, you know, for Americans, like I'm glad I have my children in the U.S. now. There's a lot of things about the U.S. I really love, and my family's here, obviously. And so I think there are some great things about, you know, what women can accomplish here and sort of the choices you have, but I would like it to be better. So I would like to think about the ways that Finland developed what it has and the sort of role of egalitarian relationships in all of that, and why it is that, that people there as parents are sort of happier, and people in the U.S. parents are less happy than people without kids. So, you know, I would still choose to have my kids in the U.S. I just want it to be a better place.
Well, remind us, what rights do you have? You're a woman in the States, you've got a job, and you're pregnant. What are your rights? What about maternity pay? What about statutory maternity leave?
Right. I mean, the funny thing about the U.S. is so much of it is state-based, so it sort of, it does vary, but nationally, there's no guaranteed paid maternity leave. There's none. Some states do offer some. There are laws about women, you know, that your position needs to be held. If there is a maternity leave, you need to be able to return to the same position. But, you know, there's very little. There's no universal daycare, which is another piece of all of this. I think that this sort of long parental leave goes hand in hand with universal daycare in some ways. You know, the moms or parents are able to take care of their children in the beginning and then transition into this system that everyone is a part of. That all sort of works together. It's more expensive to provide childcare to really little babies. And so, you know, it just, those two things go together, and the U.S. has neither of them right now.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I mean, it's good to know that actually some experiences are just universal. I mean, the row about breast versus bottle, I mean, that does appear to be something that causes a commotion everywhere in the world. People just can't agree on what you should do if you're struggling with breastfeeding.
Yeah, that's true. And one thing that I saw that was positive was in Finland, the public health nurse told Anna, like, do what works for you, because the, you know, health of the mother is important to the healthy baby. So, you know, just sort of centering the mom in that way is really important. The other thing that I saw that was sort of interesting was just how much of this messaging is conveyed over social media. So there's like this flattening where even if you have differences within the country and perspectives on this, so much of it is just shared. I mean, the woman in Kenya was on Instagram all the time, like looking at, you know, these things and sort of trying to make sense of it and how she should incorporate it into her life. So I thought that was really interesting. And also in Finland, how, you know, they would get these ideas in the US, from the US social media about how hard parenthood was and that maybe they should delay having children and all this stuff. But in fact, it was like, you know, bringing in the US kind of stuff to Finland, where on the ground things are much easier. So, yeah, I mean, there's all sorts of stuff, but I think now it's not even, you know, sort of locally based and not even national. It's, you know, international and all over social media. So it's a hard time to be a mom in that way, too, just to make sense of all of things.
Well, yeah, it is hard. It can also be absolutely brilliant as well. And the
yes,
best,
it can.
The best thing.
I don't want to say that it's not. I mean, no. I don't want to, you know, there's universal joys as well that sure. I saw the women sort of really enjoying their children. So, yeah.
Abigail, lovely to talk to you. Thank you very much for giving us the time this afternoon. It's Abigail Leonard, and I really recommend this book. There's so much in it. Four Mothers, A Year in Motherhood Around the World. It would be a... well, would I recommend it to someone who's pregnant? Well, yes, actually, because there's a lot you can learn from this. I like this message. Pain relief is available in Japan if you ask for it. It's just not offered, so it's not imposed, the rule. My wife had kids there. There was no problem. I think that message is from a man. I'd like to hear from the woman involved about how desperate she was when she asked for that pain relief that they eventually did give her. I mean, perhaps we shouldn't be too surprised that Japan is struggling with its birth rate if it's not offering pain relief to women in labour routinely. Right. Abigail was talking to us from Washington. Also currently speaking in Washington is no less a person than Donald Trump. He's saying he's going to deploy the National Guard to the Capitol, Washington, D.C.
A lot of people, most I've ever seen in this room. And we're here for a very serious purpose, very serious purpose. Something's out of control, but we're going to put it in control very quickly, like we did on the southern border. I'm announcing a historic action to rescue our nation's capital from crime, bloodshed, bedlam, and squalor, and worse. This is Liberation Day in D.C., and we're going to take our capital back. We're taking it back under the authorities vested in me as the President of the United States. I'm officially invoking Section 740 of the District of Columbia Home Rule Act. You know what that is? And placing the D.C. Metropolitan Police Department under direct federal control, and you'll be meeting the people that will be directly involved with that. Very good people, but they're tough, and they know what's happening, and they've done it before. In addition, I'm deploying the National Guard to help reestablish law, order, and public safety in Washington, D.C., and they're going to be allowed to do their job properly. And you people are victims of it, too. You know, you're reporters, and I understand a lot of you tend to be on the liberal side, but you don't want to get mugged and raped and shot and killed. And you all know people and friends of yours that happened. And so you can be anything you want, but you want to have safety in the streets. You want to be able to leave your apartment or your house where you live and feel safe and go into a store to buy a newspaper or buy something. And you don't have that now. The murder rate in Washington today is higher than that of Bogota, Colombia, Mexico City, some of the places that you hear about as being the worst places on earth, much higher. This is much higher. The number of car thefts has doubled over the past 5 years, and the number of carjackings has more than tripled. Murders in 2023 reached the highest rate probably ever. They say 25 years, but they don't know what that means because it just goes back 25 years. Can't be worse. Our capital city has been overtaken by violent gangs and bloodthirsty criminals, roving mobs of wild youth, drugged-out maniacs and homeless people. And we're not going to let it happen anymore. We're not going to take it.
Donald Trump, not doing a lot for the Washington tourist office, I don't think, there. But anyway, he's deploying the National Guard to sort out Washington, D.C. More later with Callum McDonald on Times Radio between 4 and 7. Let's talk money with our personal finance guru, Adam Shaw. This week, we're focusing on your credit score, because whether you're going for a mortgage, a car loan, or even actually a mobile phone contract, your credit score is the silent gatekeeper deciding your fate. But what is it and how is it calculated? Right, Adam, what is it?
Well, it's a number created by a variety of credit score agencies. So you won't have just one credit score. You might have a number of different credit scores. And that itself actually isn't the end of the story, because the agencies create this score and then each lender or shop scores you in their own ways. They take that data and they may go, well, we feel these elements of that credit score are more important. So if you're rejected by one store card or one mobile provider, doesn't mean that another one won't give you credit. And the reverse is true. Just because one accepts you doesn't mean everyone accepts you. But that's how it's what it is. It is calculated on your payment history. So do you always pay everything on account, on time, rather? How much you owe, and if you're close to your credit limit, we can talk a bit more about that, but that's really important, and how often you apply for credit cards. So that's okay. Basically how it's calculated.
But how do I find it? How do I know how I'm rated?
Really easy. If you're over 18, you can write an old-fashioned letter or even online to any one of the main credit rating agencies. Experian is one of the big ones. There's three or four of them. You just Google that and it will tell you. And they should provide you with your credit score free of charge. And it's quite important to do that, because there might be mistakes on it which you can correct. And those mistakes will have a big impact on how companies view you. So it's sort of important to know that what they have on you is correct.
Right. How would they have got it wrong?
Well, people make mistakes, don't they? So it might be that the data's wrong, but it can also be, and I think this affects a lot of people, they can link you financially to other people, which you may have said, that's not fair. Mm. So you may have rented something with someone. You may have an ex-partner, either formerly married or just been with them for a long time. You're no longer with them, or you are with them, but you say your finances are separately. But they may go, no, here is a financial link to this person, and that person has a poor credit rating, therefore you are affected by that. So there's lots of ways that they could have that something wrong, or indeed they could have some old data on you which you say, well, that's really not relevant anymore, and you issue what is called a notice of correction, and that should help really solve that. And you would have to do that for each credit rating agencies. There are only two or three: Experian, Equifax, TransUnion. They are the main ones.
And what if you've just had a run of bad luck and you know your credit score is bad? Is there anything you can do?
Yeah, there are a number of things. So if you want a sort of checklist of how to improve your credit score, number one, try and make sure you're on the electoral register. You should do that anyway, because that way you can vote and you should be voting. Making sure you're on that register helps with a lot of other things, but it's seen as a stability indicator. Pay things on time. The more complex one, which I think is really interesting, is don't max out your credit allowance. So if you've got £1,000, let's say, credit allowance on your credit card, don't run it up to the limit. Weirdly, it is actually better to open two credit cards and only use half of your credit allowance. In fact, I've heard it talk about trying to be below a quarter of your credit allowance actually is a good idea. And that way, because the lenders think, oh, if you're really near to maxing out everything, that looks like you're really in trouble. So there's a balancing act. Don't go near your credit limit, but also don't apply for 1,000 credit cards, because that's also an indicator. You want a sort of nice middle path. And also, you can, you know, big things like county court judgments, if you had a debt you're not paid, do stay with you for a long time. But other things should disappear. And if they haven't disappeared after a while, you can sort of raise that with the credit rating agency.
Adam, lovely. Thank you very much indeed for that. And there is more at betteraskadam.com, www.betteraskadam.com. Adam has written a post on how you can raise your credit score. It is almost, three and a half minutes to four.
Early breakfast on Times Radio with Elavon. As a new day dawns, Times Radio connects you with the latest breaking news and provides intelligent opinion on all the morning headlines. Plus, get ahead of all the markets with updates, analysis and insight with Times Radio's daily dedicated business bulletin. Early breakfast, every Monday to Friday morning from 5 on Times Radio with Elavon, your world of payments. Find out more at elavon.co.uk.
Listen to Times Radio on your smart speaker. Just say, play Times Radio.
How are you looking so fresh?
It's my new Samsung Galaxy Watch 8. It's got this thing called Running Coach, which creates custom training plans just for me. Oh, and that's our cue to pick up the pace.
What? This isn't fast enough. Oh.
Smash your fitness goals with a new Galaxy Watch 8. Buy today at Samsung.com. Requires smartphone on Android 11 or above with the latest version of the Samsung Health app.
By river, ocean and expedition, you can now explore all seven continents with Viking. Start planning your journey today and discover for yourself why Viking was named Best River Cruise Operator and Best Luxury Ocean Cruise Operator at the 2024 Times and Sunday Times Travel Awards. Viking, exploring the world in comfort. Learn more at viking.com.
At Kia, we're excited to announce that the refined new Kia Sportage is available in showrooms now. Secure your test drive today to explore its advanced technology and stylish, sporty design. Order before the 30th of September to get 5.9% APR representative and £1,000 PCP finance deposit contribution. Search the new Kia Sportage to book your test drive. T's and C's apply. Kia Finance.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
This is Times Radio.
And Ron has taken me to task. To be fair, quite a few people have taken me to task this afternoon, but I understand it. The temperatures are rising, and that's the way people are feeling. Ron says, contrary to your glib remark, Jane, Donald Trump is obviously helping the tourist board in Washington by making Washington, or attempting to make Washington, much safer for tourists. How could that possibly be a bad idea? Ron, I was just attempting a bit of levity, a little bit of sarcasm. You shouldn't do it. I'm not funny, and I should learn that I'm not. I just keep trying. Right, I will be back tomorrow, whether you like it or not. Don't forget, off-air, this week it's with Jane Mulcairns and me, and she was on very good form with Jane earlier on, so it's quite a good edition, a meaty edition of off-air coming your way at 6. Who can I thank today? Anthony Cheng was producing, also ably assisted by Felix, Arwin and Eve, and the technical operator was Ryan Boyden. And Callum McDonald is next. He's covering for John Pienaar. Busy old night on Drive. Stay with Times Radio. It's almost 4 o'clock.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Jane. Hello, good afternoon. It's 4 o'clock. This is Callum McDonald sitting in for John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive. The headlines: French President Macron says an international coalition led by the UN should be set up to secure Gaza. And President Trump says he's sending in the National Guard to Washington, D.C. as he pledges to rescue the nation's capital. Coming up on the programme, President Trump wants to be known as the peace president, but where does the evidence really take us? We'll explore with the Times World Affairs editor Catherine Philp and foreign affairs expert Tim Marshall. Plus, we'll take a look at the book from Nicola Sturgeon that's causing controversy in politics, and how is Vice President JD Vance's trip to the Cotswolds going?
This is Times Radio.
First, though, with the latest news, here's Andy Hayes.
Thank you, Callum. Good afternoon. French President Emmanuel Macron says an international coalition under a UN mandate should be set up to secure Gaza. He's told BFM TV it would fight terrorism, stabilise the territory and support its population. He is opposing an Israeli military occupation. British surgeon Nick Maynard has recently returned from Gaza, where he's been treating victims of the fighting. It was his third trip since the Hamas attacks on October the 7th, 2023.
On this occasion, it was really quite horrific. The malnutrition, the multiple deaths I saw in babies, children, adults from malnutrition, the multiple shootings of young teenage boys at the food distribution points. I saw absolute horrors there, the like of which I would never have imagined I would see in a civilized world.
President Trump has announced a major change in the way the U.S. Capitol is going to be run.
And placing the D.C. Metropolitan Police Department under direct federal control, and you'll be meeting the people that will be directly involved with that. In addition, I'm deploying the National Guard to help reestablish law, order, and public safety in Washington, D.C., and they're going to be allowed to do their job properly.
He's described Washington as a situation of total lawlessness. Here, three teenagers aged 14, 15 and 16 have been arrested on suspicion of murder on the Isle of Sheppey in Kent. Police were called to Laysdown-on-Sea late last night. A man in his 40s was confirmed dead at the scene. A girl and two boys remain in custody. Drivers over the age of 70 could face mandatory eye tests as part of an overhaul of road safety laws. It's described as the biggest shake-up of driving rules for almost two decades. The CEO of Age UK, Paul Farmer, has told Times Radio, the age of 70 seems a bit arbitrary.
Well, I don't think it's entirely dependent upon age. I think it's an interesting question about why 70 is that point. And it could potentially be older, it could potentially be younger. And I think it's just a question of ensuring that we do think about a regular eye test for drivers of all ages.
In football, Crystal Palace have lost an appeal after being demoted from the coming season's Europa League. They went to the Court of Arbitration for Sport after UEFA ruled they had breached multi-club ownership rules. They'll now be in the Conference League instead. As TalkSport's Tom Clayton explains, if one person has a stake in two clubs, then those teams are not allowed to play in the same competition.
Crystal Palace had a minority shareholder, a chap called John Textor, and when Crystal Palace won the FA Cup, they qualified for the Europa League. Now, a club that John Textor owns in its entirety, Lyon of France, they had also qualified for the Europa League.
And remember, you can hear the Times' renowned foreign correspondents analysing the biggest global security stories every day on our World in 10 podcast.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app and via your smart speaker. Times Radio Drive with Barclays Business Banking.
Hello, good afternoon. It's 4 minutes past four on Monday afternoon. It's the 11th of August. Welcome to Times Radio Drive. This is Callum McDonald in for John Pienaar while he's on holiday. When a US president chooses to meet a leader, an invader, and frames that meeting as the moment to end a protracted war on behalf of the victim, it forces an urgent question, doesn't it? Is President Trump good for peace? President Trump's decision to meet Vladimir Putin in Alaska on Friday to discuss the war in Ukraine is being sold by some as a necessary reset. Critics view it as a diplomatic gamble that could sideline President Zelensky of Ukraine and upset European security. Russia currently holds roughly a fifth of Ukrainian territory, including Crimea and large parts of the east, and the war has been grinding on for years. Any negotiated settlement that fails to secure Ukraine's territorial integrity or credible security guarantees risks leaving the fundamental cause of the conflict unaddressed. Polling suggests Ukrainians are war-weary and that some domestic appetite for compromise exists if it can deliver security and an end to the fighting. But peace without Ukrainian consent or adequate guarantees may be an armistice in name only. Trump's foreign policy approach is focused on these high-stakes personal diplomacy strategies, the image of two leaders alone striking a deal. Putin enters the summit as the occupying power with clear territorial demands. Ukraine, the party whose land is at stake, of course, risks being negotiated about but not negotiated with. Ukrainian President Zelensky's insisted that any settlement that excludes Ukraine is invalid He says repeatedly there is no path to peace that sidelines his country. European and NATO leaders have publicly urged that Ukraine be at the table and are sceptical about bilateral bargains that could undercut collective security. So today, is Trump good for peace? The case in favour, perhaps, a direct US-Russia dialogue which could unlock compromises and end a deadly war sooner than the fighting might. The case against, without Ukraine's full participation and those security guarantees and alignment with NATO and the EU, a deal risks becoming a transfer of territory and potentially influence that rewards the aggressor, Russia, that destabilises the European order and only motivates further aggression. Peace is not just about the absence of guns and drones and bombs, but surely about the presence of justice and security as well. This is Times Radio Drive. I'm Callum MacDonald. Lots to come on the programme this afternoon. We'll consider more on President Trump's domestic agenda as he announces he's going to deploy the National Guard to Washington, D.C. Later as well, the latest on Vice President J.D. Vance's trip to the Cotswolds. And we'll consider the Education Secretary's comments that white working class pupils are being written off. What does she mean? And does she have a point? First, though, let's begin with President Trump, who likes to remind us of his foreign policy successes. He's brokered a ceasefire between India and Pakistan and peace deals between Armenia and Azerbaijan and Rwanda and the DRC. And he seems optimistic about his summit with President Putin of Russia on Friday. He's giving a press conference right now. He seems to have forgotten where this defining conference on Friday is actually taking place.
And it's embarrassing for me to be up here. You know, I'm going to see Putin. I'm going to Russia on Friday. I don't like being up here talking about how unsafe and how dirty and disgusting this once beautiful capital was.
Well, until that moment, we were certainly under the impression he was going only so far as Alaska on Friday. Meanwhile, Palestinians continue to starve and die, and Israeli hostages remain in Gaza as Benjamin Netanyahu, Israel's prime minister, plans to occupy the entire strip. Despite the Alaska summit on Ukraine, Trump has decisively failed to deliver peace, of course, in 24 hours, as his promise had it on the campaign trail. Later, we'll host a debate between President Trump's former ambassador to Denmark and former White House Director of Public Affairs under Bill Clinton to consider whether Trump is good for peace. But right now, let's begin our programme and look at Donald Trump's work on the world stage with regular experts, friends of the programme, Catherine Philp, the Times World Affairs editor. Hello, Catherine.
Hi, Callum.
Hello. And also Tim Marshall, former foreign correspondent and author of Prisoners of Geography. Hello, Tim.